this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, January 25th, 2009, and this is show number 188. I'd like to start out the show with a shout out from my mom. You've heard her before doing tech reviews for us, and many of you have written to me with a simple phrase, "Your mom rocks." She loves that. Well, I went out to hang out with her last week, and I asked her if she'd like to respond. Here is her eight-second response.
Hi there, all you Silicast fans. I'm here with my crazy daughter, and she asked me to address you. Rock on!
Well, you heard it straight from Mom. We have a new shortcut. We're apparently called the Silicast. She loves hearing from you guys, so keep up the fun feedback. Well, remember how thrilled I was that we got to do an episode of the Mac Roundtable live at Macworld? We posted the audio on the Mac Roundtable website, and of course it came through the podcast feed too, but it turns out Chuck Joyner of More Podcasts Than I Can Count has a new video podcast he calls Mac Voices at macvoices.tv. And it turns out he brought a video guy with him to Macworld. And the good part of this long, drawn-out story is that Chuck let me embed the entire video of that show that we did live on the Macworld show floor, and I was able to embed it over on podfeed.com. You can finally see what Katie Floyd and David Sparks look like, along with Victor Cahiao, Chuck Joyner himself, Adam Christensen and John Chambers, and even the effervescent Don McAllister. Head on over to the site and see my amazing Technicolor dream coat as you listen to Chuck make fun of it. Well, Steve and I had to send in a broken Sony receiver to the place where we bought it, complete with an extended service contract. That place we bought it was Circuit City. Now, I know you know the punchline of this story, but help me go through this anyway. Well, I was in line dealing with the customer service people a couple of weeks ago, and I tweeted on Twitter about the agony of customer service at Circuit City. Within an hour, I had a tweet back from a guy who works for Circuit City. Over the next week and a half, we debated about how to solve my problem. Well, imagine my dismay on last Friday that when we found out that Circuit City was liquidating and they still have my $600 receiver. Well, I wrote to the guy I'd been talking to and explained that I was certain he had far worse problems on his hands, like losing his job, than my silly receiver, but I was wondering if there's anything that could be done. Well, my new friend Chuck acknowledged the email on Friday night, and on Monday he sent me an email explaining what would happen, that I would actually get it back, and telling me that was his last day at work. Well, you know what? I started following him on Twitter, and I got a tweet from him that said, "Allison, Chuck here. Thanks for the follow. Let me know how your receiver issue works out. Closure for both of us. See you in Twitter sphere." Think about it. How's that for customer commitment? You really should follow Chuck, too, over at twitter.com/, it's Chuck Stater, but it's spelled C-H-U-K-S-T-A-T-E-R. I mean, this guy, on his very last day of work, cared about my receiver. I don't know about you, but I'm not sure I would have been that big a person to really take care of people, so this guy really impressed me. So this is a big shout-out to my new friend Chuck. By the way, we did get this receiver back, so Chuck was good to his word. We just connected it right before the show, or I should say Steve connected it, and I don't know if he's finished connecting the 286 cables yet to find out if it's fixed, but they did assure us that the extended warranty is still good because it was bought through General Electric. I got to tell you, there was one other funny thing happened. As I walked into the store at Circuit City, it was all a bustle with people working like crazy to sell things off, crowded with customers looking for a good deal. On the outside of the building, they had a huge sign up on the wall that announced, "Going out of business." Well, the funny part was that they put that sign directly above the Verizon Wireless sign. Yes, the very brightly lit Verizon Wireless sign, helping to illuminate the "going out of business" sign. I took a picture and showed it to the Verizon Wireless guy inside and suggested that at the very least, they might want to shut off their sign. He seemed to get my point. Last week on the show, I talked a little bit about the Mac community because someone had mentioned as a switcher how nice it was to find this group of people who were so willing to help. I mused on whether there isn't a Windows community, or whether maybe we just never found it, or because we drink our own bathwater so much, we never even looked. Phil from Boston wrote a comment on the blog about my question. Here's what he said. "Hi, Allison. I would like to share my thoughts on the online Windows communities. For the PC user, Yahoo Answers is a place to get how-to help on just about any computer-related subject. For the geekier MCSE types, my favorite place to get help and to help others is at the Mark Manassi Tech Forums. Sometimes Google is still the best place to get help, especially when you can type in the text of an error message. I know, there's no shortage of those. When I see discussions about how PCs are getting mucked up and slow, I wonder how that is possible. I never have such problems. It doesn't take long, though, for reality to set in, and then I think back to all of my family and friends' computers and how much time I spend fixing them. Like last weekend when I fixed a friend's computers and my brother's computer, too. Hey, it's good for the social life, I guess, since some of these friends I would hardly ever see if it wasn't for Windows. How's that for looking on the bright side? Phil. Well, I love this, Phil. One of my favorite things to do when we visit Steve's relatives is to fix things on their computers. Maybe I'm not as social as I pretend. I'm so much more comfortable in front of the computer than in those touchy-feely human conditions. Thanks for the tip on those forums and on Yahoo Answers. As a neophyte Windows user, I'm often too embarrassed to ask my dumb questions. I need somebody to have a dumb question corner for me. Like, I still can't figure out how to add a new printer. I moved to a new office, and I've got all these people around me I've asked, and no one knows how to do it either. They had somebody do it for them. Well, my solution has been just not to print anything. It's been 3 weeks I've been in the new office, and I haven't had to print anything yet.
Hi, Allison. George from Tulsa, reporting on my new duplexing laser printer. Here's the problem. There are times I must print and mail multiple copies of lengthy tax returns. Our heavy-duty duplexing, collating, stapling copy machine died. Toward the end, it often jammed, misprinted, and even shredded originals. The mourning period was short indeed. Think Munchkins dancing around Oz singing, "Ding dong, the witch is dead." But what to do about my tax returns? My solution was to buy a duplexing laser printer. Brief internet research showed the Brother HL5250DN to be my clear choice. On the shelf at Staples a couple of blocks away, it was $271, including tax, and the $70 rebate really did show up. One heads up, the Brother Print dialog box is not the same in different Mac programs. The duplex option can be hard to find. Last week's Apple updates brought new Brother drivers. Perhaps that will help. It's always possible to print to PDF, then use Preview to print to paper. No trouble finding the duplex option there. The printer has many print options I've not tried. Its built-in Ethernet will connect directly to a network. I'm just running it USB connected to my Mac, and we're getting along ever so well. The Brother HL5250DN. 100% of your printing on half the paper.
Well, George, I never tire of your reviews. You have that great Tulsa drawl, and at the same time, you get to the point quickly and succinctly. That's a real trick. I can't believe you can get a good quality monochrome laser printer for under $300 now. If I just printed, like ever, I'd consider getting one of these myself instead of all these inkjets I have lying around. For all the listeners, I'd like you to take some lessons from George here. He sent in a beautiful audio recording. He sent in the full text of his review for our hearing impaired friends. He sent in two images for our sighted friends. And he even sent in a short video of the Brother HL5250 in action. It's worth watching this 13-second video. Thanks a lot, George. My friend Nancy is working on creating a website for a nonprofit organization called Gangs Out of Downey. She's learning how to use WordPress and wanted some help understanding how to upload theme files to her WordPress installation on her server. What tool do you think I might have considered to do a tutorial for her? Well, of course I use ScreenSteps. I wrote up tons of explanation bits while I took screen snapshots. I pointed with arrows where to click. I drew boxes around things to highlight areas of interest. I created URL links right in the documentation. Then I ran spell check when I was done. I made a lot of mistakes. Anyway, it was so easy to make a beautiful tutorial for her. I'm emailing her a PDF file so she can print that out and keep it in her notebook for quick reference. I also put it up in the sidebar on podfeet.com under the heading of tutorials. I've been creating quite a few little tutorials up there. You should go check them out. If you'd like to be able to create little or big tutorials and manuals for your friends and family, or better yet, for your business to actually make money and improve customer support, check out Screen Steps over at screensteps.com. Make sure you use the coupon code NOCILLA, that's my name spelled backwards in all capital letters, for 25% off your purchase. Well, I'm going to prove that it's only an ever so slight Macintosh bias here. I'm going to talk a little bit about Windows 7. You may have heard that it came out in beta just a little bit ago, so I jumped at the chance to try out this new version of Windows because you could play with it for free. You know I'm not a huge fan of Windows, but you also know I love to try new things, and I'd heard such great feedback on it that it sounded like fun to me. You can download it through Internet Explorer only, so I downloaded it using my Vista laptop, and I picked up a license code. Now, I didn't want to booger up that production machine, so I threw Windows 7 on the HP Mini Note that I got a while back, just to see how it performed on a seriously underpowered netbook. The Mini Note has a 1.2 GHz VIA C7-M ULV, which stands for Ultra Low Voltage Processor. Who's ever even heard of that one? Well, anywho, the download that you get to start with is an ISO image. So before I could download or load Windows 7 on the Mini Note, I had to burn the image to a DVD. Now remember, I mentioned last week that Windows doesn't come with a built-in ISO image burning application. So I trolled my geek Windows friends, and my buddy Keith suggested ImageBurn from ImageBurn.com, and that's spelled ImageBurn.com. ImageBurn is freeware, but they do have a nice PayPal button on their site, so if you do download the software and find it useful like I did, throw them a few bucks. I was very impressed with the simplicity of ImageBurn. It was exactly what I wanted. I put a couple of screen snapshots in the show notes so you could see how beautiful this application is. All you get is six big icons that show the six different things you can do. You can write an image file to disk, which is what I needed. You could write files and folders to disk, create image files from disk, create image file from files and folder, and then verify disk and discovery. That would be simple enough, but they have these great pictures. You can tell what each one means without even having to read. You know, I like that. Hey, quit making fun of me. This was a really nice feature. I liked it. Well, they even had a line from a song at the bottom of the window. It said, "It's the eye of the tiger. It's the cream of the fight." I thought that was a nice touch. The second image I put in the show notes shows you all the great info they give you after the fact. Well, the real test of ImageBurn was not whether it had cool pictures, but whether it actually did correctly put the ISO image on the disk. I borrowed a DVD drive from my friend Kevin, and I threw the disk in there, and sure enough, the Mini Note recognized the image on the disk, and I was off to the races. Well, it turns out when you install Windows 7, you get a choice to do an upgrade if you're already running Vista, but if you're running XP, they pretty much do a clean install. I say pretty much because they do offer to set your applications and those sort of things aside in a separate folder called Windows.old. Since I have XP on the Mini Note, I took that option. Install went very quickly, I'd say less than an hour. I'm not going to do an exhaustive review of Windows 7 for several reasons. Mostly because I don't think I found anything unique to add to the reviews I've already been able to read online. There's tons of them. I can't verify that it does feel faster than Vista to me, and that's on the Mini Note. Remember how underpowered it is? Well, I've tried to install a few odd applications that didn't go well at all. I got messages on two Lotus products that said I had to be on a higher version of Windows, oddly enough. Firefox did install without a hitch, and so did Adobe's Air and Twirl, my favorite Twitter client. I've had trouble keeping a mouse recognized, though. I tried three different ones in case it was something wrong with my wireless mouse. I tried two wired ones and the wireless one, and they seemed to kind of come and go. One oddity is that the network connection bars for the wireless always shows no bars, even when I'm connected to a good network and successfully, you know, working. Connecting to a network is way nicer on Windows 7 than it is on Vista, by the way. You actually see the networks when you click on the icon in the taskbar. You don't have to go open up the network control panel and say, "I want to connect to a network." It's just right there. With these issues I'm seeing, I'm kind of surprised that Leo Laporte and Paul Theriault have been saying that Windows 7 is ready now and that Paul is using it full time. I certainly wouldn't put it on that kind of footing. I mean, it's pretty good, but maybe they're just comparing it to the way they said Vista was ready. Well, something I really like is that you can pin applications to the taskbar, meaning that the applications stay where you put them. It's always frustrated me on Vista. There's also some sweet keystrokes to manage the windows. Remember Fiwi from last week that let us pop up two Finder windows side by side so it was easy to drag windows between two files between two windows? Well, Windows 7 has that built in. There's two ways to do it. You can drag a window all the way to the right side of the screen, and it will turn the right half blue, like a light pale blue kind of overlay. Well, you let go, and the window will pop to take up exactly half the screen vertically. If you do that same thing on the left, it'll pop to the left, and then you've got what Fiwi gives us on the Mac. Well, the second way of doing this is not as snazzy looking, but way easier. You hold down the Windows key and the right arrow, the front window just pops to the right-hand side of the screen. Windows left, it goes to the left side. Windows up arrow gives you a full screen of the front window. Keep going, and you find Windows spacebar, and that'll show you the desktop. But it jumps back to a full set of windows when you let go. My personal favorite, though, is Windows home key. That takes every single darn window you've got open and minimizes all of them except the one you had in front. I love that because my ADD kicks in something fierce, and I just keep tons of windows open all the time. I never like to close applications. I keep about 326 things open at all times, so this is a pretty handy feature to me. So I can't tell you that Windows 7 is an improvement over Vista, because after about 30 minutes of using Windows 7, I was kind of missing those features when I had to go back and do some real work in Vista. But guess what? Lifehacker posted a hack that lets you get these cool keystrokes in Windows XP or Vista. How cool is that? I tested this hack on Vista. I'm calling it a hack, but it's because it's from Lifehacker, but I think it's just a regular application. Anyway, it worked exactly like I'd hoped. I just have to learn how to make things run at startup in Windows. Guess I got to go over to Yahoo Answers and ask how to do that, because I don't know how to put something in the startup items folder or whatever. If I can figure that out, it's going to be perfect. I put a link to this application at Lifehacker over on podfeet.com. Well, I was having so much fun playing with Windows 7 on the HP Mini Note, to be honest, I can't really see that much on the high-res 9-inch screen at my age. It's pretty sad. So I thought it might be even more fun to put Windows 7 on my MacBook Pro. Now the problem is I don't own any virtualization software for personal use. I have Parallels for work, but not for fun. So I decided to check out the free VirtualBox software from Sun Microsystems that they went ahead and let go open source. You can download VirtualBox from virtualbox.org. The coolest part about VirtualBox, besides the fact that it's free and open source, is that you can run it on Linux, Windows, Mac OS X, and Solaris. You can't beat that with a stick. Hey, wait a minute. Maybe I should install Linux on my Mac in VirtualBox and then install Windows 7 on top of Linux. That would be awesome. I'd open a hole in the space-time continuum or something like that, so I better not. Well, anyway, I downloaded the installer, and in no time, I had it up and running. Since I had the Windows 7 ISO on a DVD, I was able to slap that in my drive, click on New, and follow the instructions to set up a new virtual machine. Of course, I failed the first three times I installed it because I didn't read very closely while I was doing it. The installer kept failing because while I thought I was putting in a 10 gigabyte partition as the size for the virtual machine, I was actually putting in a 10 megabyte one. It didn't seem to like that. Well, once I got past that hurdle, it was clean sailing. I pointed the installer to the DVD drive, and in less than an hour, I had Windows 7 running on my Mac. Still having some network problems with it, though. You have to tell VirtualBox what network card to use for wireless on the virtual machine. And the four choices are all ones I've never heard of. I did some trial and error flipping through each one and starting up Windows 7, and I found one of the four would actually show up to Windows, so that when I went into Windows, it would say, yes, you have network connectivity. Unfortunately, it seems to attach and disconnect from the network, and worse yet, it caused instability of the network connection from the airport on the OS X side too. I have to quit VirtualBox and log out of my user account on the Mac side just to get it to stop being flaky. I need to just spend some quality time with it and figure out a better configuration. I just did an upgrade to VirtualBox, so maybe that'll fix it. If I do get it working, I'll be sure to post the configuration that finally works. Well, after I was done playing with Windows 7 and I got bored because I couldn't keep the network up, I decided to download Ubuntu 8.10 and install it on VirtualBox. I had a little bit of messing around because, again, I wasn't paying attention, but I did get it installed, and I'm running it actually right now while I'm doing the live show over at ustream.tv/nozillacast, and I have a web browser open inside Ubuntu, inside VirtualBox on my MacBook Pro that I can surf the web on while I'm actually doing this live show. So no network connectivity problems, and I'm using the same network card that I chose for Windows 7. So it kind of points to Windows 7 causing some hinky problems in a virtual environment. So maybe that's something they don't have going quite as well. But it's kind of cool. I've got Ubuntu going now, and I don't know what I'll do with it, but I'm sure it's going to be really cool because it's awesome because I can. And, of course, while I was working on that, I captured screen snapshots of the entire install process in Screen Steps. So I'm hoping to make a tutorial on that, too.
Hi, this is Dom Burr of Otaku no Podcast and Voices of Aaron Podcasts. New episodes coming soon. Honest. Here with another quick tip / review / I don't know what you want to call these things. This one is for you boot camp users, so if you're not a boot camp user, then you might want to tune out. Have you ever wanted to easily back up or restore your boot camp partition? There are plenty of tools that you can do this on Windows, such as Symantec's Ghost or the program that Leo likes to talk about a lot, Drive Snapshot. These tools don't work too well on the Mac because of the way boot camp partitions are structured. Or, what if you're moving to a bigger hard drive, or better yet, a new computer? You don't want to sit there and have to reinstall all of your Windows applications and stuff, do you? I mean, let's face it, we want to spend as little time as we have to in Windows. Or, what if you're the IT guy at a company or a school, and you need to blast out the same install of Windows onto a whole bunch of computers, complete with your own custom set of applications and drivers and whatnot? For example, Alex Lindsay, famed head of the Pixel Corps, always says that his Macs have both Mac and Windows partitions on them, because he uses some 3D modeling stuff that only is available in Windows. Wouldn't it be nice if Alex's IT guy could just blast out the same identical install of Windows with all of his 3D tools onto all of his Macs and not have to sit at each Mac and install Windows 50,000 times? If you answered yes to any of the above, then WinClone to the rescue. WinClone is a great program that runs on the Mac. Yes, it runs on the Mac side of things, fortunately. And what it does is it lets you easily back up or restore bootcamp partitions to or from image files. Think of it as kind of like super duper for bootcamp. It works with both XP and Vista installs, and works with both FAT32 and NTFS formatted Windows partitions. It's really quite simple to use. Just run the program, it'll come up with a window with two tabs, Image and Restore. The Image tab is used for backing up your bootcamp partition to an image file. Just select your bootcamp volume and click the Image button. A Save dialog will appear where you can choose where to save the image file and what to call it. You can also enter an optional description. It took me about 2 hours to image a 30GB XP install. Now, if you need to restore from an image, that's where the Restore tab comes in. Just select it, drag an image file onto the little restore box or click the button to select one, and choose the destination partition and click Restore. Note that you must use the Bootcamp Assistant program located in your Applications Utilities folder to create the partition before restoring to it. Here's the best part. If your new partition is bigger than the original partition was, it'll automatically resize it to fit the bigger partition. So, this is great if you get a bigger hard drive and you want to resize your Windows partition. Or, if, let's say, you're like me and you accidentally made your Windows partition too small, just use WinClone to image your too small bootcamp partition to a file, use Bootcamp Assistant to erase that partition and create a bigger one, and then just blast the image back onto it. Boom. The only improvement I could suggest to this program is if the author could add a direct copy from partition to partition option so that we could directly copy from one partition to another instead of having to go through an intermediate image file. This would be handy, for example, if you had a Mac Pro with two hard drives in it and you wanted to maintain a backup of your bootcamp partition on the second hard drive. Then you could just directly copy from partition to partition without having to go through an intermediate image file. Other than that, it's a great program, and I highly recommend it. I saved the best for last. The program is absolutely free. Yes, free. Although the author does ask that if you find it useful, you send him a little donation through PayPal. It's available for download at the link that I'm sure Allison will put in the show notes. Anyways, hope you enjoyed this one, and see you next time.
Well, I always love your reviews, Donald. You explain what's cool, you explain how things could be cooler, and you give us practical uses. Keep your reviews coming. I always like them.
Hi, Allison. It's Jane from Perth. I received an email recently from one of the NoSilicast listeners, George from Tulsa. And at the end of his message, he mentioned a quick and simple way to copy the file path of a folder or file to a document within Mac OS X. So I thought I'd pass on this handy hint to the rest of the NoSilicast listeners. I copy file paths regularly in Windows XP at work, but I rarely need to do so on my Mac. And to be honest, on the odd occasion when I've wanted to list a file path, I've just typed it manually into the text. Now you'd think it would be a simple task to achieve copying and pasting a file path on a Mac, but no, it isn't. My first thought was to do a right-click and a Get Info on the required file to bring up its file path in the Info window. And yes, there in the General section, it shows the file path. But you just try to select that text in order to copy it, and no, OS X won't let you do that. Goodness knows why we shouldn't be allowed to achieve this simple task from the Info window. But there is another way of getting that tricky little bit of text into a text editor. This method involves the Services menu within Finder. Now, I don't know about you, but I seldom look at the long list within the Services menu. And even if I had gone searching through Services, I doubt I would have recognized the option that actually performs the task of copying a file path. But once the required service is pointed out, it all becomes so obvious. First, select the file or folder whose path you wish to know. Then, within the Finder menu, click Finder, then Services. Towards the end of the long services list, choose Text Edit, and then New Window Containing Selection. This opens a new text edit window with the file path already pasted in and linked to that file. However, although this copies and pastes the file path into the document, the actual file path is not copied to the clipboard. As you can see, if you do a Ctrl-V or a right-click paste in a document, it won't repaste that file path. Getting that file path onto the clipboard requires a little more ingenuity. Now, I did some further Googling into the subject and found that there were various ways to produce a file path, including dropping the file onto an open terminal window, using Text Wrangler, which I don't have, and using Apple scripts and Automator scripts. And there are a few free and paid utilities that provide a contextual menu option to copy the file path to the clipboard, including one called File Examiner at $10, and the freeware utility called File Utils CM, from abracode.com. I, of course, chose the free option of Files Utils CM, which installs a plugin that provides the ability to set different file or folder attributes from the drop-down contextual menu. Amongst the various options it offers is Copy Path to Clipboard, from which you can merrily paste your file path to wherever you may desire. So there you have it, a few alternative ways to get your file path copied into a text document. You can see screenshots of these two methods including the full list of options offered by the File Utils CM utility, by visiting my website at galacticstrings.com, where you can also find the links to the relevant software websites. No doubt there are a few more examples of how to achieve the copying of file paths on the Mac, and if you know of any more, then add them to the comments section on my website. Cheers, everyone, and see you all next time.
Well, thanks, Jane. That's pretty clever. I wonder if I would remember to run this the next time I have to write down a path. It's so tedious to write them down, but with all the answers I'm giving, I'm doing all the time for people, it might really come in handy. Like telling them where that darn plist file is, and I'm hoping I just spell it right when I get there. Thanks for a great little tip. It's actually kind of fun, too, that you're talking on the NoSilicast about George from Tulsa, and George from Tulsa was just on the NoSilicast. It all comes full circle. Well, Wednesday night was the season premiere of Lost. Lots of anticipation on this one. Cleared my calendar. Steve has it all set up. Even Kyle was ready to pay attention with us. We're actually already in front of the TV, and at exactly 8 p.m. when the show starts, our cable goes out. Seriously! I mean it. No TV, no cable, no internet. You know, a bunch of people I told that to said, well, you TiVo'd it though, right? Yeah, we TiVo'd it. We TiVo'd a big white screen for an hour and 20 minutes. Anyway, our only saving grace was the EVDO card and the cradle point so we could all still get online. I think there might have been some bad words said in my house that night. One of Kyle's friends remarked on how sad it was that all three of us set our Facebook status to how mad we were that we were missing Lost all at the same time. And of course, Steve and I tweeted about it a little bit as well. Well, one Twitter response made up for all of this, though. Paul, also known as iSherbet, famous from last week's show, tweeted about an application called TED from TED.NU as a solution to my Lost woes. He didn't give me any more hints other than telling me TED was ripe for a review. You know how susceptible I am to suggestion. I had no idea what TED was, but I jumped right in. Turns out that TED is an open source application that runs on Windows and the Mac, and it finds episodes of TV shows online through BitTorrent. Now, we've spoken about BitTorrent quite a bit before, and you know I don't condone stealing content at all. But I figure here, I'm paying over $100 a month for cable TV, and I was denied Lost, so I walked into this one guilt-free. When you first open TED, it asks you to set up a few things, like your time zone and where to download the torrent files, things like that. Next, you have a window that has an option to add show. The window has a big blank area on the left, a blank area on the right, and a blank field that says select a show. Down at the bottom, it says add a custom show. That's the only button I had to push, so I pushed it, and I typed in Lost. That's when things went horribly wrong. Okay, maybe not horribly, but I didn't find Lost. I found some mutant show with Lost in the middle of the title. I canceled out of all those windows, and when I got back to the original window, it turned out it had populated with a lovely list of normal TV shows. Turns out the big blank area takes a few seconds to populate with your local shows, so just give it a second before you go pushing buttons. Sheesh! You can use the field at the top to search for a show or scroll till you see something you like. Once I chose Lost, I got an interesting graphic from the show and a choice of next episode, last aired episode, or custom episode. I delightedly clicked on last aired episode, which showed it was Season 5, Episode 2, airing on January 21st, which is the one I just missed. Well, actually, I missed Episode 1 and 2, which both aired that night. In just a few seconds, it found my show, Open Tomato Torrent, which happens to be my current BitTorrent application, and it began downloading and uploading Lost for me. Note that you have to have a torrent application already resident on your machine. TED doesn't have one of its own, and it won't download one for you. The website for TED had a few advantages listed, and one of them was that you could watch in your own language. I wasn't quite sure how to test that other than to change my time zone, but I thought it might be of interest to some of you to go check that out. Of course, there is documentation for TED, but I didn't mess around with that. Anyway, if you're looking for an easy way to find TV shows, go check out TED at TED.NU.
Hi, this is Alex. You know, from inside your Mac, I want to tell you about caring for your gadgets. You love of your Mac, and you want to take care of it. So the best place to keep it running at its best is the Apple Store. Likewise, you want to keep your car in tip-top shape. You should own a Honda or an Acura, and live in the LA or Orange County area, and if you don't, you might as well be running Windows. But if you do, you should call Honda Bob. He is to your car, as the Genius Bar is to your Mac. He keeps your car in perfect running condition, and in the unlikely event something does go wrong, he will fix it for you with minimal hassle. So what are you waiting for? Go poke around on his website at hdabob.com. Then, fire up your iPhone and give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321. Or, open up mail.app and shoot him an email at hdabob@aol.com. HDA Bob's mobile service is not affiliated with Honda, Acura, or Honda Worldwide.
Well, it's that time of the show again. Time for Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz from BartB.ie. Happy Saturday, Bart.
Yay, Saturday. I love Saturday.
You actually got some sunshine over there, you said?
Briefly. It's changed, of course, since. I checked the weather forecast, and it said, you know, sunshine in the morning followed by rain. So I said, okay, if I'm going to get out for my exercise, if I'm going to get any photographs this weekend, I best get out of bed now. So I dragged myself out of bed at the whopping hour of 11 o'clock in the morning.
Oh, my gosh, 11. That's crazy.
It's early for me, actually, but let's not go there. Ooh, excuse me. I have the hiccups again, which that's everyone always finds hilarious, except for me.
I like it. Oh, dear. Well, we've had rain for like 2 days in a row. I'm kind of distressed. God. Yeah, and it looks like maybe 3 or 4 more to come. It's horrible.
Is that your quota for the year then?
Pretty much, I think. I did get some good shots of my trunk last night with the water on it from the rain, and I polished my car last weekend, so it looks really cool.
Oh, there's a beating thing.
Yeah, the beating up was awesome. Well, we probably should actually talk about tech here a little bit. I think we have a security light update and 2 new security light issues. Why don't you start us off?
So security is slightly heavy, I guess. last week we talked about the Safari RES vulnerability, and we said that the workaround was quite simple, that you go into Safari, you go to the preferences, you go to the RSS tab, and then you change it to any default reader except for Safari. Turns out that doesn't actually completely, totally, and utterly fix the problem. And the guy who discovered the vulnerability initially thought that that was a valid workaround, but he's since realized it isn't a valid workaround. So he's updated his blog post, which is linked in the show notes, and he now has a new fix. It's not difficult, but it's a little bit more involved. You may remember quite some time back when we had a problem with RTSP and Safari, or not Safari, QuickTime.
Oh, yeah. I remember that.
We had to install a preference pane called RC Default App, which then let us disable RTSP.
Okay.
Now we have to install that same preference pane.
Okay.
So the little preference pane is linked from the link in the show notes. Okay. RC Default App is a preference pane that shows up in your preferences, obviously. And it just lets you control what default program does every file type and every URL type. So in this case, we install it, and then we go into it, and then we go to the tab that's marked URLs, and then we choose feed from the URL type, and then on the other, on the left-hand side, we pick feed, and on the right-hand side, we put it to either disabled or anything but Safari. Then we do the same for feeds, disabled or anything but Safari, and then we do the same for feed search. So 3 times we have to do it for 3 different types of URL.
Now that sounds complicated as Bart's describing it, but the link he gave takes you to a page that just has 5 steps, and if you follow those 5 steps, you should be okay for a while.
We think this is it now.
Now, what's interesting, I'm looking at it, it says the notes that you sent over say that users of Safari on Windows are also affected. If they have it installed but don't use it for browsing, they're not affected. But I know research assistant Niraj uses Safari on Windows. So that's a concern.
It is a concern, absolutely. So Apple need to patch this. Yeah. But they're not the greatest at patching quickly. However, they do patch occasionally. See that for a segue? and they have done so to QuickTime for Mac and Windows. We're being very cross-platform today. This one is... Basically, there are 7 flaws, but each and every one of them is pretty much identical. They all have, if you, there's a link in the show notes to the Apple Knowledge Base article that sort of gives you the full breakdown, but every single solitary one of them is a remote code execution vulnerability, and they all have basically the same blurb. Impact. Accessing a maliciously crafted RTSP URL may lead to an unaccepted application termination or arbitrary code execution. Impact. Viewing a maliciously crafted QTR movie file may lead to, you know, viewing a malicious AVI movie may lead to, viewing a malicious movie file may lead to, viewing a malicious movie file may lead to. So they're all arbitrary code execution or unexpected application termination, which means either it crashes or you get hacked.
Now, to prove that I actually do listen to you, that remote code execution one, that's the one where other people can completely and totally control your computer, right?
Yep.
That's so the one we don't like. We really don't like that one.
Yeah. Now, in this case, it's not quite as bad as the Samba one on Windows had last week, because you actually have to do something. You have to browse through a page that contains a dodgy video, or download a dodgy video, or in some way use QuickTime to view a dodgy video.
Okay.
Or a dodgy RTSP URL. So yeah, you have to do something to initiate it. But that something could be as simple as just surfing the web randomly. So it's still pretty bad.
So the answer is to run your updates, right?
Exactly. On Windows, run whatever Apple update thing Windows has. And on the Mac, just run your regular software update.
Now, one point I want to make here is how many people don't run updates. There's a worm that's been traveling around affecting millions and millions of Windows machines, even though Microsoft patched it in October. So millions upon millions of people are not just letting it do the darn updates. So let it do the darn updates, for crying out loud. How hard is that?
Yeah, or they're running pirated copies and they're afraid to do updates because they're afraid it might make their pirated copy not work.
Well, so the spam bot machine or the botnet is alive and well and very strong right now.
Yep, which brings us into another nice segue, don't steal software.
And I get to do this one. So a Mac Trojan horse was inserted into a pirated copy of Apple's iWork 09. So iWork 09 was just released by Apple right around the time of the Macworld Expo. So somebody took it and, you know, pirated it and inserted a Trojan horse in it and put it up on the file sharing services. And you know what? This one actually kind of makes me happy. If you're out there stealing Apple's iWork, I'm really happy that you got a Trojan horse. I'm sorry. That's just stealing software just drives me crazy. You wouldn't walk into a store and shoplift. Why would you steal software that people spend a hard time, a long time working on? It's just wrong.
I think it's because a lot of software is made by big corporations that are quite faceless, or because some companies charge ridiculous amounts, Adobe, and that makes people think it's okay, and they don't realize that everywhere isn't like that, and software is written by plain ordinary people, and a lot of software is written by, you know, one-person operations, and it's their entire livelihood, and if you steal it, you are basically stealing bread off their table.
Well, and even companies like Adobe have come around and come out with less expensive versions of things. You know, I mean, I think one of the greatest ideas they ever had was making Photoshop Elements, because very few people, it turns out, actually paid $600 for Photoshop, but a lot of people can afford the $100 for Photoshop Elements. So I would expect that they cut down on their piracy significantly by coming out with a reasonably priced product that did a lot of what people really needed.
Yeah, certainly. And actually, it's interesting that this happened in iWork, when this is iWork 09 is the first version of iWork that Apple released without the need for a registration key. So you stick in the CD, you install it, and that's it. Nothing else. Nothing
so
more to do. No online
then.
Activation.
That's a great idea. Don't motivate them to be good to us, right?
Ugh. Yeah.
Oh, that makes me crazy. I just found out a young friend of mine I was talking to was talking about how he got, you know, $4,000 worth of free software. And I said, well, how'd you get that? And another young friend of mine, who I'm really disappointed in now, had gone out and pirated it all for him. It's like, well, why? Stop it. Just stop it.
Yeah, and the really ironic thing is he probably doesn't need any of it.
Well, he's going into learning some film stuff, and that's what he wants to do for his career. And I think a lot of it he probably will use. But there's probably alternatives that he could have used that are less expensive and learn and open source and blah, blah, blah. There's ways around
it. There's usually educational licenses available for these things at significant discounts.
Yeah, educational discounts frequently don't work if you're in high school. You have to be in college for those to apply. Like the,
that's a bit silly.
Yeah, I've never quite understood that. It's like the Apple educational discounts, a lot of times you have to be in college instead of high school.
So it's very unfair.
Yeah. But there's
definitely light versions. You don't go around stealing software. And if you do, I mean, this is another example of Windows stuff coming over to the Mac. If you're silly enough to go and install something from a dodgy site, which is full of people who steal stuff and probably don't really have very many morals, why would they not steal from you?
Now, why do you call that Windows stuff coming to Mac? I think that's just stupid people and mean people getting together.
This type of attack has been really common against Windows users for years.
Okay, so it's just we're just catching up then.
Yeah, it's just we're now being targeted too.
Right, and I'm not losing any sleep on that one.
No, this is a pattern we've been seeing, you know, where more and more Windows-type attacks are now becoming targeted at the Mac, too. Yeah. Now, this is actually a very nasty Trojan. This thing, basically, it installs itself as a system service running as root, which starts as a system startup service, so not as a user startup service, so it's up before you even log in.
Oh.
It has full read and write access to every single solitary thing on your entire machine. First thing it does is phone home to a botnet to take orders. It's built with a self-updating system so that the botmaster can send keyloggers and anything else the botmaster feels at your machine, and it will automatically go and download it and install it, all without you having to do anything because it's all running as root. It can do keyloggers. It can do anything.
Wow.
It is completely expandable. Basically, it's a permanent backdoor into your computer for the bad guys to do absolutely positively anything.
It sounds like the only solution to that is, what do they call that, scorched earth reinstall of the OS from scratch, huh?
It really is, because although it's easy to remove the Trojan itself, because we know where it hides, we know what its package name is, we know where on the disk it sits, it's just a couple of files, you have no idea what it's done.
Yeah.
So if it's been there at all, you have absolutely positively no idea whether there's now a rootkit running, which is by definition undetectable. That's about as nasty as it gets. There could be stuff hidden anywhere. They could have edited something as simple as the ls terminal command that suddenly do all sorts of nasty stuff. You just have no idea. Your system is not trustworthy. You need to get your data off, and you need to completely, totally, and utterly nuke the machine, or you will not be safe.
Definitely. Now, is there a way of knowing you've gotten it?
Oh, yeah, it installs itself in a whole bunch of... It's a very standard, so let me see. It's 67/system/library/startup-items/iWorkServices. Makes two files there, a startup-parameters.plist and an iWorkServices executable.
But how would you know to go look?
Well, the /library/startup-items is a standard location for stuff that starts on boot.
I mean, for instance, I personally haven't gone and stolen any software, but if I had been to a dodgy site, I would then know to go look and see if that stuff is there, I guess. But you don't know if you've been infected, right?
Oh, no. The whole point of this thing, this is something that tries to silently take over your machine.
Right.
The emphasis on the word silent. It doesn't want you to know it's there. But if you have installed a pirated copy of iWork, then you need to check. So /system/library/startup-items, it was something called iWork Services, a folder, you're in deep doo-doo. /user/bin/iWork Services, if that exists, you're in deep doo-doo. /library/receipts/iWork Services.pkg.
Or they should follow the link in the show notes.
They should follow the link in the show notes. But basically, if you have this, you are now reaping the rewards for being a thief. And I actually don't feel sorry for you at all.
Definitely. Definitely not. All right. Well, that's probably enough grim...
preaching.
Yeah, we've probably made our point, but definitely have some opinions on that. So let's have a more enjoyable conversation. Let's talk about why Drobo's stupid.
Let's argue, you mean.
So, Bart and I know that you guys enjoy when we have differing points of view. So whenever we find something that we are differing on, we figure we should air our argument in public. And
it's almost become a thing, isn't it? When we're chatting away on iChat or whatever, and you and I end up disagreeing on something, before we get like two lines into the disagreement, one of us will say, we should put this in the show.
Maybe we should call it arguing across the pond or debating across the pond. Well, this one you're completely wrong about. So, all right.
I'm always completely wrong according to you.
Oh, all right. So my premise is, okay, so everybody on Earth, everybody who's anybody is advertising the Drobo. And I think we've gotten into this thing where if you don't know what Drobo is, it's a high availability RAID, easily remove drives, put in new drives, hot swappable storage device. Is that a reasonably accurate description?
Reasonably. It's okay. Not RAID, but
oh,
let's
it
not go there.
Oh, okay.
Well, no, because RAID is crap, to put it mildly. And for RAID to work, you need to have all of the identical same size discs.
Oh, right.
If you have a disc that's any bigger than another disc, the extra bit is completely ignored, can never be used. RAID is a very flawed and crappy system, and it's because RAID is so flawed and crappy that the Drobo exist.
Okay. All right. Well, so now, by the way, I should have changed this. This isn't why the Drobo is stupid. This is, you don't really need one, is really my premise here. So all the podcasters are advertising the Drobo right now, and I know I am completely susceptible to this. As I start thinking, oh, I need a Drobo because everybody's got a Drobo, apparently. I should get one. That sounds really cool. But I don't need a Drobo, and I think most of us don't need a Drobo. So the way the Drobo works is you have to buy the box first. The cheapest Drobo you can buy, the bottom of the line, old generation, the first generation one is $350, and it has no disk drives in it. Now, what's magic about this thing is you can throw in two drives. You can throw different size drives, like Bart was saying, and the different size drives, it'll match them up, and you get some overhead loss and that sort of thing. So if you want, for example, to have a terabyte of storage for your backups, you're going to have to put in 2 terabytes of storage, and you're actually not going to get 2 terabytes because you lose 2.1 gigabytes to overhead. So to get a terabyte of storage, you have to pay
You could stick 3 500-gig disks in and get more than a terabyte.
Okay, but is that how much
or
is 3?
4 cheaper disks? I mean, you know, there's lots of possibilities. Old disks, new disks.
Okay, but
so a terabyte drive is new and state of the art. You don't have to go for terabyte drive.
Okay, but under no circumstances can you get to 1 terabyte for under $500. But I can buy an external terabyte drive from buy.com for $110. So, assuming that your requirement is to run backups, I don't think you actually need one, and this actually buys you very much. If this is your only storage of a certain piece of data, then maybe it starts to make some sense. But as a backup situation, you've already got a copy of it on your hard drive. This is your backup. Why do you need it on a $500 item instead of a $100 item? And now I will let you actually talk.
Okay. You're assuming that the terabyte is it. But, you know, experience has told me that that never works out, because I started off with a 40 megabyte hard disk and I thought I'd never fill it.
Mm-hmm.
That's 5 photographs.
I started without a hard drive.
Yeah. Okay, so right now you have a terabyte, and then a year from now you suddenly realize that you need more and disks have become cheaper for bigger ones, so you buy another disk. But you don't want to get rid of your terabyte because you can't afford to do that. So then you stack another external disk on top of your previous external disk and, you know, continue ad nauseum, and soon you end up with a clutter of disks everywhere. So the way I look at a Drobo is, it's not right. If you just want a terabyte now, it's clearly not the cheapest answer, as you've very clearly outlined. But this isn't about now. This is look at it over a 5-year period. Think about it into the future. Whenever you want more space, you just pick up a cheap hard drive and slot it in.
But I That's can it. Pick up a cheap hard drive a year from now, too. And I didn't spend
$350. It'll be another external. So your desk is going to clutter up with more and more. I am proof of this. I am proof.
You had to throw drives away, though. You had to throw drives away because you just bought 4 cheap drives. You just told me that was going to be your solution. Not to put a single...
It depends on what you do, but you only have to change 1 drive at a time.
Right. So do I.
So I pick... Yeah. But you're going to want... If you buy a 1 terabyte drive, you're not going to throw that away.
Eventually,
even if you
I
need
will.
2 terabytes, why would you throw it away? I mean, drives don't change that quick. If I bought 4 cheap 500 gig hard drives, I'll throw one of them away and stick in 1 terabyte drive, and I've suddenly gained another 0.5 terabyte to play with, and I can do that again when I need it.
So you
so
paid
it
for
keeps growing
you just said
forever.
It. You just said it right there. You just paid for a terabyte, but you only got 500 gig. I buy another terabyte, I got another terabyte.
Yeah, but you have, right. Looking here in front of me now, I have 1, 2, 3, 4, I have 5 external disks sitting here. I have 1 terabyte. I have 2.5 terabytes, which really isn't a lot. If I had a Drobo, I'd have it all in a Drobo without any issue.
Okay, I will concede 1 point. It's neater. It's less clutter.
And it scales. I don't have to keep moving your data. That's the beauty. You build your file system once, and you just keep expanding that same file system. You don't have to worry about what's on what disk. You don't have to worry about dragging stuff over and back and moving and changing and chopping. you just take out one disk at a time and it worries about everything else.
For $400 so you have one more. For $400 more.
It's an investment in the future.
It keeps lack of messiness and labor.
Lack of messiness, actual expandability. I mean, if you're anyway into photography or videography or anything like that, you are going to need more and more space, and you're going to want space that's reliable. You don't want to lose all of your family memories because one of the drives goes.
But I've got, this is my backup drive. This is not the only place it exists. This is the second place it exists. Actually, it's the third place it exists.
Okay, if you want a terabyte and that's your backup drive, where's your primary stuff? Because there's no way your MacBook Pro has a terabyte.
I don't have, okay, I have over 50,000 photographs, and it's only about 70 gig. So I can see, I contend that you don't need a terabyte either, if that's what you're talking about, is your precious family photos.
I'm shooting raw.
Yeah, how many terabytes of photos do you have right now?
I don't have much because I haven't been able to keep much. I've been deleting, you know, I've been burning them very, very heavily.
Okay, but I mean, you aren't, you don't need terabytes. You need gigabytes for photos today, and I would say for at least a year from now.
Okay, but I'm not thinking a year from now. I wouldn't look at a Drobo as a one-year investment.
No, but a year from now, you can buy more drives. A year from now, you can
buy more drives. But then I have more drives. The problem I have, that's what I've been doing. I've been doing exactly what you're suggesting, and now I have a big cluttered mess of drives.
So it's all
about
clutter.
And I have some files in one drive and some files in another drive, but it's clutter in every sense of the word because I can't find stuff because I don't know what drive it's on. Okay. I have to buy my drives in pairs because I want some sort of redundancy. So I have two matching 250 gig drives, I have two matching 500 gig drives, and I have one extra drive that I just use for Time Machine. But in total, I have five disks, but I really only have 750 gigs. Even though technically I have 1.5 terabytes.
So if you, I tell you what, take $30, go buy yourself a little label maker and label your drives like I did, where it says this one is Time Machine, this one has movies on it. I just have little labels on mine.
Well, the other problem I have is that I'm completely, totally, and utterly out of power outlets. So I can't keep my drives powered up. It's honestly, it has become an unmanageable mess.
Do they have surge protectors there in Ireland?
Oh, I always buy strips with surge protectors because we tend to have lightning and stuff.
Okay, so you've got like 5 or 6 on each one of those. So you got like 12.
Oh, let me see. There's I actually buy 6 long strips, and I have 2 of those completely full. So and then I have an extension cord coming out of one, which you probably shouldn't do. So I have 8 on that one and 6 on that one. It's not scaling at all. I have reached the end here, and I technically need another drive. I need more space.
Okay, so in your world, clutter is worth $500, $400, let's say more.
Clutter, power, the ability to actually find my files, and some sort of safety in having my files, yeah.
So I think part of your contention is that, and I think where we actually do differ is I'm thinking about this as a backup. You're thinking about it as its only location. So that's why you need redundancy there.
I can't possibly have a terabyte, multiple terabytes. I can't possibly have, you know, expanding amounts of data in my laptop. My laptop has an 80 gig drive and it will always have an 80 gig drive.
Why?
When I buy a new laptop, it will have more. But it's not, you know, I buy laptops and make them last at least 3 years. In that time, hard disks balloon. So my internal storage is never going to be, you know, 2 years into owning my laptop, my internal storage is always going to be too small.
Okay. What I don't understand is why it's not in your list of possibilities to upgrade a hard drive inside a laptop. I do that all the time. I mean, right before I stopped using the previous one, I had a 320 gig drive used to put my 3-year-old MacBook
Pro. I'm not going to get the terabytes. Laptop hard drives are slow.
But you don't have terabytes worth of data.
Well, actually, I do. Right now, I have in secured storage, okay, I have 750 gigs.
No. You have storage capability of 750 gigs. What do you actually have in terms of data? I mean,
well, it's pretty much full. I'm looking for a new drive.
What? How many copies? What are you storing? You have movies?
There certainly are movies on it. There's all sorts. Yeah, movies build up quite quick, actually.
And so that's precious family heirlooms you got to back up, the movies?
Yeah, there's certainly not stuff I want to lose.
Yeah. See, I don't save movies.
Okay, I'm not saying everyone should have a Drobo, but I certainly don't think a Drobo is stupid. Well, no, I mean,
okay, and that's why I changed.
Everyone shouldn't have a MacBook Pro.
You don't need a Drobo. Is what I really. I'm going to go back and change the notes and claim I never called it stupid. I've edit privileges.
It entirely depends. If you're the kind of person who is into, if you're seriously into photography, if you want to shoot RAW, if you're thinking of doing HDR work, your file sizes will absolutely balloon. If you just bought a Nikon D90 and you now are starting to shoot video as well, it's going to completely and utterly balloon. If you're into making home movies, your data is going to balloon. In all of these situations, a Drobo is useful to you. If you're just thinking of a drive for Time Machine, buy an external drive that's twice the size of your internal drive and forget about it. That's it. You're done.
And I think that's what I'm trying to say, too. I think we might actually agree here. I don't think normal people need a Drobo.
I think I'm normal.
Really?
Well, okay, not really, but still. I think there's more
You're
people who need one than you think. Well, no, because if I was mainstream, I'd be boring.
Yeah, I don't know. I just think that there's other ways around this that are a lot less expensive. The one thing on video,
what I'm actually thinking of doing, speaking of other ways around this, is I have some old PC hardware, which will hold 4 IDE devices. So I'm thinking I buy a motherboard with a RAID controller on it, and I buy 4 identical hard drives, and I wedge them into an old PC. But that's still not as good as a Drobo.
Right.
And I'll probably end up spending $300.
Now, one thing you're forgetting in your count of all your drives is that you're still waiting for the drive you had to buy in order to install Aperture, right?
Yes, but I was somewhat intelligent about that. I bought a little USB-powered one that doesn't need a power adapter.
So it's cluttery, but doesn't need power.
It's also really small. It's one of those little Western Digital Passport drives.
Those are cool.
Yeah, because I want to be able to take it with me wherever my laptop goes. Because I usually need my photos when I have my laptop.
Right.
When I go home to family or stuff. So it's no good to me if my photos and Aperture is going to be on my Mac at home. That's not the situation I want to go with.
Now, why did you decide to do that instead of just slapping a new hard drive inside your MacBook Pro? Well, I say slap an hour and a half with a tiny little screwdriver.
I'm not ripping my MacBook Pro apart because it's still under Apple care. So it would have to go to an authorized Apple dealer. Mm. I'm in Ireland. That is a pain. It's much easier to buy a Western Digital passport drive.
I see. Well, I think that that's a reasonable decision. I guess. I just have Pat come over and do it for me.
Yeah, see, I don't have a Pat on call.
Yeah, that's what...
Although, Pat, if you're coming over to Ireland...
That would be nice, definitely. All right, well, it's possible that Bart needs a Drobo, but I don't think you do, the normal person listening, the regular normal person.
Yeah, these are our listeners we're talking about.
So you're saying they're not mainstream either?
I would think I don't think so. Well, I'm sure there are people who consider themselves mainstream, but I'm fairly sure we have a lot of good, proper nerd users here who will definitely troll through terabytes of data.
Well, I don't know. You know, I'm up to about 290.
Send us in your emails, folks.
Well, actually, yes. I would like to make a shout out to the crowd. If you think Bart's an idiot and that nobody needs a Drobo, let me know. I don't want to hear the other side, though.
Okay, other people should email me.
Definitely. Well, you know, I mean, I'm looking at my disk drive right now, and I haven't thrown more than, I don't know, maybe 10% of the photos I've taken in 6 years away. And I've got, I don't have a lot of movies, but I do have a lot of audio recordings. I actually have every photo I've taken on my drive twice for no clear reason that I can figure out. I've got to fix that.
Twice on the OneDrive?
Well... That
doesn't actually achieve anything.
No. And it wasn't on purpose. I had them on the drive, but I wanted to do what you told me to do, which was let go and let Aperture organize my photos for me. Mm. So I dragged them all into Aperture, but I've been chicken to throw them away outside of Aperture because I somehow have this feeling that they're not really in Aperture. And if I throw them away, they'll be gone. Even though I've backed them up.
That's what you need an external hard drive for.
Which I've already done. I've already done that too.
For a bunch of DVDs?
I just can't get myself to... Well, DVDs would be hard because I'd have to break it into chunks because it's like 40 gig.
But they're all in folders.
Yeah, I know. I could. I'm just chicken.
Once you have them on your DVDs, then you can trash them.
It may be
therapeutic to click that.
Well, I also have every episode of the NoSilicast on my hard drive, which I never go back and listen to them there. They're also on the server.
Yeah, that's something... Well,
and
I actually archive
up.
Off... It's another thing, actually, that takes up a lot of my disk space is whenever I do recordings for Victor Show or whatever, I archive off the GarageBand file onto my external discs.
See, I throw away the GarageBand files. I throw away the AIFFs a week after the show. So, but even the raw MP3s at, you know, 20, 30 meg a piece times 185 shows or so.
That builds up.
It does. So, and with all of that, I'm under 300 gig. So
I still think if you had more, you'd fill it easily.
Well, I'd just get sloppier. I'd stop paying attention.
Well, I'm not sure, you know, deleting your GarageBand files is a sign of, you know, not being sloppy. I think if you had the space, surely you would keep them.
Yeah. Well, the AIFFs at least. So I probably
would keep them, but why? Well, in my case, particularly for the Terminal series, I mean, at the moment I'm doing them for Victor Show, but who knows what they may be useful for later. Hmm. So I may want to re-edit them slightly, take out bits of them or whatever. Yeah. And I don't want to be taking bits out of an MP3.
No, but if you save the AIFFs...
And then sticking that back into GarageBand.
If you save
I can't actually edit my separate tracks and stuff.
Yeah, that's true.
So if I was going to keep one, it certainly wouldn't be the AIFFs, because I can regenerate those if I have the .GarageBand file.
But coming up on 4 years on the show, I haven't ever gone back and edited any of those, so I don't know why they're on my disk drive.
Well, I wouldn't count on the server. Certainly the MP3s I think you need to keep.
Oh, yeah, but I could pile them off onto DVDs and stick them in my safe deposit box.
Actually, no, be careful with DVDs, because I've recently been going through some old stuff on DVDs. Now, they're old backups of stuff I don't really need. Mm-hmm. But 4 out of about 20 had suffered from good old bit rot and
really?
Were unrecoverable.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one reason I'm buying more hard disks, because I'm getting everything off my DVDs. And stick it onto hard disks.
Maybe what I should do is the older drives that I have that are little, that are, you know, not really worth that much now, you know, a couple hundred meg,
a couple hundred meg, that is old.
Yeah, a couple hundred gig, I mean, I could pile them all onto there and put that drive in the safe deposit box. It'd probably be smaller than the DVDs.
And safer.
Yeah, for a while.
a hard drive stored away is less likely to degrade than
really?
The DVDs stored away.
Why?
Because DVDs actually have a fairly small shelf life, but the hard disk has a longer shelf life.
Hmm. I've never had a DVD fail. I've had a lot of hard drives fail.
Well, hard drives fail through use, and they can. There is a small chance that the head gets stuck if it isn't spun up in a very, very, very long time. But if you spin them up once every 3 or 4 years, just plug it into the USB, let it mount, and then unmount it straight away, then it will outlast DVDs.
I mean, that's a mechanical part with little spinny things and grease and all that. I could definitely see that jamming up if you didn't play with it once in a while.
You see, the problem is the data on your DVDs is sort of chemical, and it sort of degrades. Uh-huh. And so once the layer where your data is degraded, you have no data.
Good point. All right, well, one of these days I'm going to sit down and clean it up, because I probably have 100 gig I could clear out, but I'm just lazy.
Or conservative.
Conservative, that's it. All right, well, I'm glad we settled this and we're agreed that we don't really need the Drobo.
Apart from me, who definitely does.
All right, Bart, we're going to be able to... Oh, we're actually going to need to shift next week, because Steve and I are going to be judging an academic decathlon on Saturday.
How do you academically run 10 different ways?
Well, yeah, Dick, I'm not quite sure if it's got that. Well, there's a whole lot of different tracks of information these kids have to memorize. You know, art and history and all this other slop.
So there's no running involved, even though it's called the decathlon.
Right. It's a contest of the brain, of the will, of the intelligence of these young
people. I might actually be able to enter such a contest, because I certainly can't enter a decathlon where I have to run.
Unless there was a dog chasing you.
Well, that was on the bike.
So you could do the bike part then.
Yeah, I could do the bike part of a decathlon or a triathlon or whatever. Yeah.
All right.
Not the swimming, not the running. Anyway, so let me know when, because I have no major plans for next weekend, so I'm sure I can wiggle my schedule around your decathlon.
Okay, probably on Sunday then.
Cool.
All right, Bart, we will talk to you next weekend then.
Okie dokie. Until then, happy computing.
Well, it looks like that's going to wind up another episode of the NoSillaCast. Be sure to shoot me all your emails. I love getting them to allison@podfeet.com. And you'll notice we didn't have any dumb questions this week. I sure hope to hear some more from you next week. Don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/podfeet. And of course, come on in and join the crazy nutcases over in the live show at ustream.tv/nosilicast at 5 p.m. GMT minus 8 on Sunday nights. It's a lot of fun in there, and you can meet all the regulars like Connor and Kenny and Mac Mommy, Michael King, BJ. You can even talk to Steve. We got Donald Burr in there. Who else we got in here? We got Bart. We got Gita. Let's see. Oh, they're still going. Pat's in there, and a whole bunch of lurkers. I don't think I missed anybody, but it's a lot of fun in there. So come on in and join the fun. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed. This has never happened on the NoSilicast before. There's something after stay subscribed. It turns out I forgot to talk about Rose and Debbie T, who are both in the chat room. So now I can say it. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.